Hi, this is Mrs. English, and today I'll be reading for you from Milton's Paradise Lost. I'm going to begin with Book 1. This is John Milton's Paradise Lost. I'm beginning with Book 1. I'll open up with reading his argument for Book 1. This first book proposes first in brief the whole subject, man's disobedience, and the loss thereupon of paradise wherein he was placed. Then touches the prime cause of his fall, the serpent, or rather Satan in the serpent, who, revolting from God and drawing to his side many legions of angels, was by the command of God driven out of heaven with all his crew into the great deep. Which past action over, the poem hastens into the midst of things. This is in media res, a common to epic, presenting Satan with his angels, now fallen into hell, described here not in the center, for heaven and earth may be supposed as yet not made, certainly not yet accursed, but in a place of utter darkness, fitliest called chaos. Here Satan with his angels, lying on the burning lake, thunderstruck and astonished, after a certain space recovers, as from confusion, calls up him who next in order and dignity lay by him. They confer of their miserable fall. Satan awakens all his legions, who lay till then in the same manner confounded. They rise, their numbers, array of battle, their chief leaders named. This is a listing, and of course catalog listings of the number of warriors, the array of battle and chief leaders and things, so they're very common elements of an epic. They rise, their numbers, array of battle, their chief leaders named, according to the idols known afterwards in Canaan and the countries adjoining. To these, Satan directs his speech. This is a formal speech, and of course a formal speech is another element of an epic. To these, Satan directs his speech, comforts them with hope yet of regaining heaven, but tells them lastly of a new world and a new kind of creature to be created, according to an ancient prophecy or report in heaven, for that angels were long before this visible creation, was the opinion of many ancient fathers. To find out the truth of this prophecy and what to determine thereon, he refers to a full council, what his associates hence attempt. Pandemonium, the palace of Satan rises, suddenly built out of the deep by Mulciber or Hephaestus, or his Roman name, Vulcan. The palace of Satan rises, suddenly built out of the deep. The infernal peers there sit in council. And now we begin the text. Of man's first disobedience, and the fruit of that forbidden tree, whose mortal taste brought death into the world. I have a couple of comments to make on these very first lines. When Milton says of man's first disobedience, he is not talking about Adam alone. He is not talking about Eve alone. He is talking about mankind. Milton is going to assume that we loathe or detest sin and that we love virtue. He assumes that we regret the loss of Eden, that there was a paradise that was lost, and that we long for a restoration. Of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree, whose mortal taste brought death into the world, and all our woe with loss of Eden, till one greater man restore us and regain the blissful seat. Sing, heavenly muse. Notice that Milton is invoking the muse, just like Homer would. Milton invokes his muse, but it will not be Homer's muse. Sing, heavenly muse, that on the secret top of Oreb or of Sinai didst inspire that shepherd who first taught the chosen seed in the beginning how the heavens and earth rose out of chaos. Or if Zion Hill delight thee more, and Siloa's brook that flowed fast by the oracle of God, I hence invoke thy aid to my adventurous song, that with no middle flight intends to soar above the Ionian mount, while it pursues things unattempted yet in prose or rhyme. And chiefly thou, O Spirit, that dost prefer before all temples the upright heart and pure, instruct me, for thou knowest, thou from the first wast present, and with mighty wings outspread, that I'm at line 20 now, dove-like sat'st brooding on the vast abyss, and mad'st it pregnant. What in me is dark, illumine. What is low, raise and support. that to the height of this great argument I may assert eternal providence and justify the ways of God to men. And that does appear to be the theme of Milton's Paradise Lost, to justify the ways of God to men. That's here in Book 1, line 26. Say first, for heaven hides nothing from thy view, nor the deep tract of hell. Say first, what cause moved our grandparents in that happy state, favored of heaven so highly, to fall off from their Creator, and transgress his will from, for one restraint, lords of the world besides? Who first seduced them to that foul revolt? The infernal serpent. He it was whose guile, stirred up with envy and revenge, deceived the mother of mankind. What time his pride had cast him out from heaven, with all his host of rebel angels, by whose aid aspiring he set himself in glory above his peers, he trusted to have equaled the Most High. If he opposed, and with ambitious aim against the throne and monarchy of God, raised impious war in heaven and battle proud with vain attempt, him the almighty power hurled headlong, flaming from the eternal sky with hideous ruin and combustion, down to bottomless perdition, there to dwell in adamantine chains and penal fire, who durst defy the omnipotent to arms. Nine times, line 50, nine times the space that measures day and night to mortal men, he with his horrid crew lay vanquished, rolling in the fiery gulf, confounded though immortal. But his doom reserved him to more wrath, for now the thought both of lost happiness and lasting pain torments him. Round he throws his baleful eyes that witnessed huge affliction and dismay, mixed with obdurate pride and steadfast hate. At once as far as angels ken he views the dismal situation, waste and wild, a dungeon horrible, and on all sides around as one great furnace flared, yet from those flames no light, but rather darkness visible, served only to discover sights of woe, regions of sorrow, doleful shades, where peace and rest can never dwell. Hope never comes that comes to all, but torture without end still urges, and a fiery deluge fed with ever-burning sulfur unconsumed. Such place eternal justice had prepared for those rebellious. Here their prison ordained in utter darkness, and their portion set as far removed from God and light of heaven as from the center thrice to the utmost pole. Line 75. Oh, how unlike the place from whence they fell. There the companions of his fall, o'erwhelmed with floods and whirlwinds of tempestuous fire, he soon discerns, and weltering by his side, a one next himself in power and next in crime, long after known in Palestine and named Beelzebub. This is the Lord of the Flies, from Matthew 12:24. Beelzebub, to whom the arch enemy, and hence in heaven called Satan, with bold words, breaking the horrid silence, thus began. Now, Milton has introduced the topic of his epic. He's used quite a few epic elements. Then he introduced his protagonist, who is our anti-hero, Satan himself. And now, on line 84, Satan begins to speak, and he will give an epic speech. And he's talking to his second in command, that one next in him in crime and next to himself in power. It says, though they have been lying in this state for 9 days, and Satan is finally coming to consciousness, able to speak, and says to his companion, Beelzebub, you there? You hear me? If thou beest he, but oh, how fallen, how changed from him who in the happy realms of light, clothed with transcendent brightness, didst outshine Myriads though bright. If he whom mutual league, united thoughts and counsels, equal hope and hazard in the glorious enterprise, adjoined with me once, now misery hath joined in equal ruin, into what pit thou seest from what height fallen, so much the stronger proved he with his thunder. And till then, who knew the force of those dire arms? Who knew God was so strong? Yet not for those, nor what the potent victor in his rage can else inflict, do I repent or change. though changed in outward luster, that fixed mind in high disdain, from sense of injured merit, that with the mightiest raised me to contend, and to the fierce contention brought along innumerable forces of spirit, armed that durst dislike his reign, and me preferring, his utmost power with adverse power opposed in dubious battle on the plains of heaven, and shook his throne. I lost my place. What, line 105, what though the field be lost? All is not lost. The unconquerable will and study of revenge, immortal hate, and courage never to submit or yield, and what is else not to be overcome? That glory never shall his wrath or might extort from me, to bow and sue for grace with suppliant knee, and deify his power, who from the terror of this arm so late doubted his empire, that were low indeed, that were an ignominy and shame beneath this downfall, since by fate the strength of gods and this imperial substance cannot fail, since through experience of this great event, in arms not worse, in foresight much advanced, we may with more successful hope resolve to wage by force or guile eternal war irreconcilable to our grand foe, who now triumphs and in the excess of joy, sole reigning, holds the tyranny of heaven. So spake, line 125, so spake the apostate angel, though in pain, vaunting aloud, and of course vaunting is a type of boasting, this was very common in the Iliad, vaunting aloud, but racked with deep despair, and him thus answered soon his bold compeer. And so his bold compeer, Beelzebub, replies, O prince, O chief of many throned powers, that led the embattled seraphim to war under thy conduct, and in dreadful deeds fearless endangered heaven's perpetual king, and put to proof his high supremacy, whether upheld by strength or chance or fate, too well I see and rue the dire event, that with sad overthrow and foul defeat hath lost us heaven, and all this mighty host in horrible destruction, laid thus low, as far as gods and heavenly essences can perish, for the mind and spirit remains invincible, and vigor soon returns, though all our glory extinct, and happy state here swallowed up in endless misery, but what if he our conqueror, who I now of force believe almighty, since no less than such could have overpowered such a force as ours, have left us this our spirit and strength entire, strongly to suffer and support our pains, that we may so suffice his vengeful ire, or do him mightier service as his thralls, by right of war, whatever his business be, here in the heart of hell to work in fire, or do his errands in the gloomy deep, what can it then avail, though we yet feel strength undiminished, or eternal being, to undergo eternal punishment? So Beelzebub has replied to Satan, saying, what good does it do us to be immortal if we are to be eternally punished? Whereto with speedy words the arch-fiend, this is Satan, replied, Fallen cherub, to be weak is miserable doing or suffering, but of this be sure, to do aught good never will be our task, but ever to do ill our sole delight. This reminds me of Shakespeare's most famous villain, and this is, of course, Iago, who only lives to do cruel, evil things. Line 160. But ever to do ill our sole delight, as being the contrary to his high will whom we resist. If then his providence out of our evil seek to bring forth good, our labor must be to pervert that end. So if God tries to make good out of their evil, they must make sure and pervert it. Line 165. And out of good still to find means of evil, which oft times may succeed, so as perhaps shall grieve him, if I fail not, and disturb his inmost counsels from their destined aim. But see the angry victor hath recalled his ministers of vengeance, and pursuit back to the gates of heaven. The sulphurous hail shot after us in storm, o'erblown hath laid the fiery surge, that from the precipice of heaven received us falling, and the thunder. Winged with red lightning and impetuous rage, perhaps hath spent his shafts, and ceases now to bellow through the vast and boundless deep. Let us not slip the occasion, whether scorn or satiate fury yield it from our foe. Seest thou yon dreary plain, a forlorn and wild, line 180. The seat of desolation, void of light, save what the glimmering of these livid flames cast paleful and dreadful. Do you see that plane? Void of light, but it does have the glimmering flames. Thither let us tend from off the tossing of those fiery waves. There rest, if any rest can harbor there. And reassembling our afflicted powers, consult how we may henceforth most offend our enemy. So they're looking for a plain in the midst of this darkness where they are going to go and consult and try and decide how they can most offend their enemy. Our own loss, how repair, how overcome this dire calamity, what reinforcement we may gain from hope, if not, what resolution from despair. Satan speaks again. Thus Satan, talking to his nearest mate, with head uplift above the wave, and eyes that sparkling blazed, his other parts besides, prone on the flood, prone means lying down on the flood, extended long and large, lay floating many a rood, in bulk, as huge, and here we come to a Homeric simile, an extended simile. This is line 197. As whom, notice the use of like or as to identify the simile, as whom the fable's name of monstrous size, Titanian or earthborn that warred on Jove, Briareos or Typhon, whom the den by ancient Tarsus held, or that sea beast Leviathan, which God of all his works created, hugest that swam the ocean stream, him haply slumbering on the Norway foam, the pilot of some small night-foundered skiff, dreaming some island, oft, as seamen tell, with fixed anchor in his scaly rind, moors by his side under the lee, while night invests the sea, and wished morn delays, so stretched out huge in length, the arch-fiend lay, chained on the burning lake, nor ever hence, line 210. Also, the reference up there on line 200 is a reference to the battle between the Titans and the Olympians. That's the Titanomachia, between the Olympian gods and the Titans. And so Milton here is also mimicking Homer, even in his plots. Back to line 210. Chained on the burning lake, nor ever hence had risen, heaved his head, but that the will and high permission of all ruling heaven left him at large to his own dark designs. So God has left Satan to himself. That with reiterated crimes he might heap on himself damnation, while he sought evil to others, and enraged might see how all his malice served but to bring forth infinite goodness, grace, and mercy, shown on man by him seduced, but on himself treble confusion, wrath and vengeance poured. Forthwith upright, he rears from off the pool his mighty stature. On each hand the flames driven backward slope their pointing spires, and rolled in billows, leave in the midst a horrid veil. Then with expanded wings he steers his flight, line 225, aloft, incumbent on the dusky air, that felt unusual weight, till on dry land he lights, if it were land that ever burned with solid as the lake with liquid fire, and such appeared in hue as when the force of subterranean wind transports a hill torn from Pelorus, that's a spot in Sicily, or the shattered side of thundering Etna, whose combustible and fueled entrails, hence conceiving fire, sublimed with mineral fury, aid the winds, and leave a singed bottom all involved with stench and smoke. Such resting found the soul of unblessed feet. Him followed his next mate, both glorying to have escaped the Stygian flood, which would mean a Styx-like flood of the River of Death, the Stygian flood as gods, and by their own recovered strength, line 240, not by the sufferance of supernatural power. Is this the region, this the soil, the clime, said then the lost archangel, this the seat that we must change for heaven, this mournful gloom for that celestial light? Be it so. Since he who now is sovereign can dispose and bid what shall be right, farthest from him is best whom reason hath equaled, force hath made supreme above his equals, Farewell, farewell, happy fields, where joy forever dwells. Hail, horrors, hail, infernal world, and thou profoundest hell. Receive thy new possessor, one who brings a mind not to be changed by place or time. So here Satan is asserting, I am in charge. The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell, a hell of heaven, line 255. What matter where, if I be still the same, and what I should be, all but less than he whom thunder hath made greater? Here at last we shall be free. The Almighty hath not built here, for his envy will not drive us hence. Here we may reign secure, and in my choice to reign is worth ambition, though in hell. Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. But wherefore let we then our faithful friends, the associates and co-partners of our loss, lie thus astonished on the oblivious pool. Ah, why are we leaving all of our friends to lie oblivious on the pool? And call them not to share with us their part in this unhappy mansion, or once more with rallied arms to try what may be yet regained in heaven, or what more lost in hell. So spake Satan spoke, and him Beelzebub thus answered, Leader of those armies bright, which but the omnipotent none could have foiled, if once they hear that voice, their liveliest pledge of hopes and fears and dangers, heard so oft in worst extremes, and on the perilous edge of battle when it raged, in all assaults their surest signal, they will soon resume new courage and revive, though now they lie groveling and prostrate on yon lake of fire. As we erewhile, astounded and amazed, no wonder, fallen such a pernicious height. He scarce had ceased when the superior fiend was moving toward the shore, his ponderous shield, ethereal temper, massy, large, and round, behind him cast, the broad circumference hung on his shoulders like the moon, whose orb, though optic glass, the Tuscan artist views at evening from the top of Fiesole, or on Valdarno, to descry new lands, rivers, or mountains in her spotty globe. His spear, to equal which the tallest pine, hewn on Norwegian hills, to be the mast of some great admirable, were but a wand he walked with to support uneasy steps over the burning marl, not like those steps on heaven's azure, and the torrid clime smote on him sore besides, vaulted with fire. Natheless, he so endured, till on the beach of that inflamed sea, he stood and called his legions, angel forms, who lay entranced, thick as autumnal leaves, that show the brooks of Vallombrosa, where the Etrurian shades, high o'erarched embower, or scattered sedge afloat, when with fierce winds Orion armed, hath vexed the Red Sea coast, whose waves o'erthrew Busiris and his Memphian chivalry, while with perfidious hatred they pursued the sojourners of Goshen, who beheld from the safe shore their floating carcasses and broken chariot wheels. So thick bestrown, abject and lost, lay these, covering the flood, under amazement of their hideous change. He called so loud that all the hollow deep of hell resounded, Princes! Line 315. Potentates! Potentates! Warriors, the flower of heaven, once yours, now lost, if such astonishment as this can seize eternal spirits, or have ye chosen in this place, after the toil of battle, to repose your wearied virtue, for the ease you find to slumber here as in the vales of heaven? Or in this abject posture have ye sworn to adore the conqueror, who now beholds cherub and seraph rolling in the flood with scattered arms and ensigns, till anon his swift pursuers from heaven's gates discern the advantage, and descending tread us down thus drooping, or with linked thunderbolts transfix us to the bottom of this gulf? Awake, arise, or be forever fallen. Line 330. They heard, and were abashed, and up they sprung upon the wing, as when men want to watch on duty, sleeping found by whom they dread, rouse and bestir themselves ere well awake. So they, the other legions, get up, just like men who were supposed to have been on watch, and the one person they fear comes, and they must jump up. Line 335. Nor did they not perceive the evil plight in which they were, or the fierce pains not feel, Yet to their general's voice they soon obeyed innumerable, as when the potent rod of Amram's son, this is Moses, as when the potent rod of Amram's son in Egypt's evil day waved around the coast, up called a pitchy cloud of locusts, warping on the eastern wind that o'er the realm of impious Pharaoh hung like night and darkened all the land of Nile, so numberless were those bad angels seen hovering on wing under the cope of hell twixt upper, nether, and surrounding fires, till, as a signal given, the uplifted spear of their great sultan waving to direct their course, in even balance down they light on the firm brimstone, and fill all the plain, a multitude like which the populous north poured never from her frozen loins to pass Rhine or the Dana. This is the river Rhone or the Dana. When her barbarous sons came like a deluge on the south and spread beneath Gibraltar to the Libyan sands. Line 355. Forthwith, from every squadron and each band, their heads and leaders hither haste where stood their great commander, godlike shapes and forms, excelling human princely dignitaries, and powers that erst in heaven sat on thrones. So the leaders are lining up beside Satan, leaders who, before, previously, had sat in heaven on thrones. Line 360. And powers that erst in heaven sat on thrones, though of their names in heavenly records now be no memorial, blotted out and raised by their rebellion from the books of life. So their names have been erased from the book of life. Nor had they yet among the sons of Eve got them new names. And Milton here is referring to Genesis 6 and the Nephilim, the fallen ones. Till wandering o'er the earth, through God's high sufferance for the trial of man, by falsities and lies the greatest part of mankind they corrupted to forsake God their Creator, and the invisible glory of Him that made them, to transform oft to the image of a brute, adorned with gay religion, full of pomp and gold, and devils to adore for deities. Then were they known to men by various names and various idols through the heathen world. So Milton is attempting to attribute all of the pagan gods, the classical gods of the Greeks and the Romans, the pagan gods of the Canaanites, all of these, he is attributing to that they are the fallen angels. And some of the church fathers agreed with Milton in this. Line 375. Say, muse, their names then known, who first, who last, roused from the slumber on that fiery couch at their great emperor's call, as next in worth came singly where he stood on the bare strand, while the promiscuous crowd stood yet aloft. The chief were those who from the pit of hell, roaming to seek their prey on earth, dust fixed their seats long after next the seat of God, their altars by his altar, gods adored among the nations round, and durst abide Jehovah thundering out of Zion, throned between the cherubim, yea, often placed within his sanctuary itself, their shrines, abomination, and with cursed things his holy rites and solemn feasts profaned, and with their darkness durst affront his light. First, and now we have a catalog of leaders, another epic, another format of epic. First, Molech, horrid king besmeared with blood of human sacrifice and parents' tears, though for the noise of drums and timbrels loud, their children's cries unheard that passed through fire to his grim old idol. Here in line 395, in the previous lines to this, Milton is referring to the practice of Molech. You can look it up in any Bible dictionary. And, of course, to Molech they sacrificed their children alive. Line 396. Him the Ammonite worshipped in Rabbah and her watery plain, in Argob and in Bashan to the stream of utmost Arnon. Nor content with such audacious neighborhood, the wisest heart of Solomon he led by fraud to build his temple right against the temple of God on that opprobrious hill, and made his grove the pleasant valley of Hinnom. Tophet hence and black Gehenna called the type of hell. Next, Chemos, the obscene dread of Moab's sons, from Aurur to Nebo, and the wild of southmost Abarim, and in Hezibon and Horonaim, Sion's realm beyond, the flowery dale of Sibima, clad with vines, line 410. and Ilale to the asphaltic's pool. Peor, his other name, when he enticed Israel and Sittim on their march from Nile to do him wanton rites, which cost them woe. Yet hence his lustful orgies he enlarged even to the hill of scandal, by the grove of Molech homicide, lust hard by hate, till good Josiah drove them hence to hell. He's talking about King Josiah. With these came they who from the bordering flood of old Euphrates to the brook that parts Egypt from Syrian ground had general names of Baalim and Ashtaroth. Those male, these feminine. For spirits, when they please, can either sex assume, or both, so soft and uncompounded is their essence pure, not tied or manacled with joint or limb, nor founded on the brittle strength of bones, like cumbrous flesh, but in what shape they choose, dilated or condensed, bright or obscure, can execute their airy purposes. Line 430. So spirits are unisex. And works of love or enmity fulfill. For those the race of Israel oft forsook their living strength, and unfrequented left his righteous altar, bowing lowly down to bestial gods, for whom their heads as low bowed down in battle, sunk before the spear of despicable foes. With these in troop came Ashtoreth, whom the Phoenicians called Astarte, queen of heaven, with crescent horns, to whose bright image nightly by the moon Sidonian virgins paid their vows and songs. In Sion also not unsung, where stood her temple in the offensive mountain, built by that uxorious king, whose heart, though large, beguiled by feral idolatresses, fell to idols foul. Thammuz came next behind, the next evil leader. Thammuz came next behind, whose annual wound in Lebanon allured the Syrian damsels to lament his fate in amorous ditties all a summer day, while smooth Adonis from his native work, line 450, ran purple to the sea, supposed with blood of Thammuz yearly wounded, the love tale infected Sion's daughters with like heat, whose wanton passions in the sacred porch Ezekiel saw, when by the vision led his eye surveyed the dark idolatries of alienated Judah. Next came one who mourned in earnest, when the captive ark maimed his brute image, heads and hands lopped off in his own temple on the Grunzel edge where he fell flat and shamed his worshippers. A Dagon, his name, sea monster, upward man and downward fish, yet had his temple high-reared in Azotus, dreaded through the coast of Palestine. In Gath and Ascalon and Acheron and Gaza's frontier bounds, him followed Rimmon, whose delightful seat was fair Damascus on the fertile banks of Abana or Parfar, and Parfar, lucid streams. He also, against the house of God, was bold, line 470, a leper once he lost and gained a king. Ahaz, his sottish conqueror, whom he drew God's altar to disparage and displace for one of Syrian mode, whereon to burn his odious offerings and adore the gods whom he had vanquished. After these appeared a crew, who under names of old renown, Osiris, Isis, Orus, and their train with monstrous shapes and sorceries, abused fanatic Egypt and her priests, line 480, to seek their wandering gods disguised in brutish forms, rather than human. Nor did Israel scape the infection when their borrowed gold composed the calf in Oreb, and the rebel king doubled that sin in Bethel and in Dan, likening his maker to the grazed ox, Jehovah, who in one night when he passed from Egypt marching, equaled with one stroke both her firstborn and all her bleating gods. Belial came last, than whom a spirit more lewd fell not from heaven, or more gross to love vice for itself. To him no temple stood or altar smoked, yet who more oft than he in temples and at altars, when the priest turns atheist, as did Eli's sons, who filled with lust and violence the house of God. In courts and palaces he also reigns, and in luxurious cities where the noise of riot ascends above their loftiest towers, and injury and outrage, and when night darkens the streets, then wander forth the sons of Belial, flown with insolence and wine. Witness the streets of Sodom, and that night in Gibeah when the hospitable door exposed a matron to avoid worse rape. These were the prime in order and in might. The rest were long to tell, though far renowned, the Ionian gods of Javan's issue held, and Javan in the Old Testament is Greece. God, yet confused later than heaven and earth, their boasted parents. Titan, heaven's firstborn with his enormous brood and birthright seized by younger Saturn, he from mightier Jove, his own and Rhea's son, like measure found. So Jove usurping reigned, these first in Crete and Ida known. Hence on the snowy top of cold Olympus ruled the middle air, their highest heaven, or on the Delphian cliff, or in Dodona, and through all the bounds of Doric land, or who the Saturn old fled over Adria to the Hesperian fields, line 520. And o'er the Celtic roamed the utmost isles. All these and more came flocking, but with looks downcast and damp, yet such wherein appeared obscured some glimpse of joy, to have found their chief not in despair, to have found themselves not lost in loss itself, which on his countenance cast like doubtful hue. But he, his wonted pride soon collecting, with high words that bore semblance of worth, not substance, gently raised their fainting courage and dispelled their fears, line 530. Then straight commands that at the warlike sound of trumpets loud and clarions be upreared his mighty standard, that proud, a standard is a flag, that proud honor claimed Azazel as his right. And Azazel means scapegoat. The proud honor claimed Azazel, scapegoat, as his right, a cherub tall, who forthwith from the glittering staff unfurled the imperial insigne, which full high advanced shone like a meteor streaming to the wind, with gems and golden luster rich emblazoned, seraphic arms and trophies, all the while sonorous metal blowing martial sounds, at which the universal host up sent a tone that tore hell's concave, and beyond frighted the reign of chaos and old night. All in a moment through the gloom were seen 10,000 banners. This is would be like 10,000 flags rise into the air, line 545. With orient colors waving, with them rose a forest huge of spears, and thronging helms appeared, thronging helmets, appeared and serried shields in thick array, of depth immeasurable. Anon they move in perfect phalanx, and of course a phalanx is a Greek battle arrangement, in perfect phalanx to the Dorian mood of flutes and soft recorders, such as raised to heights of noblest temper heroes, old arming to battle, and instead of rage deliberate, valor breathed, firm and unmoved, with dread of death to fight, flight, or foul retreat, nor wanting power to mitigate and swage with solemn touches, troubled thoughts and chase anguish, and doubt and fear, and sorrow and pain from mortal or immortal minds. Thus they breathing, united force, with fixed thought, moved on in silence to soft pipes that charmed their painful steps over the burnt soil. So they're marching to a pipe music. And now advanced in view they stand, a horrible front of dreadful length and dazzling arms. These are the main bad guys all lined up. Line 564. A horrid front of dreadful length and dazzling arms, in guise of warriors old with ordered spear and shield, awaiting what command their mighty chief had to impose. So they are marching to pipe music, and all the main bad guys line up, and they're carrying spears and shields. This is line 565 of Warriors Old with Ordered Spear and Shield, book 1, line 565. Awaiting what command their mighty chief had to impose, he, through the armed files, darts his experienced eye, and soon traverse the whole battalion views, their order due, their visages and stature as of gods, their number last he sums. So Satan is walking up and down the ranks of his men. He's walking through the armed files. When you see, as in line 567, armed, with an accent on the ED of armed, that means you pronounce that syllable separately. It's a device to fulfill the meter. So he marches through the armed files, darts his experienced eye, and soon traverses the whole battalion views, their order due, their visages and stature as of gods, their number last he sums, and now his heart distends with pride. and hardening in his strength, glories. For never since created man met such embodied force as named with these could merit more than that small infantry warred on by cranes. Through all the giant brood of Phlegron with the heroic race were joined that fought at Thebes and Ilium. Here Milton is comparing this force of warriors with those that fought at Thebes. That is from the Oedipus cycle, Oedipus and Seven Against Thebes, where his sons fight about who will reign, and Ilium, which of course is another name for Troy. So he's comparing these forces also with those who fought at Troy. That fought at Thebes and Ilium, on each side mixed with auxiliar gods. And what resounds in fable or romance of Uther's son, this is King Arthur, line 580, begirt with British and Armoric knights, and all who since, baptized or infidel, jousted in Aspremont or Montbalm, Damascus or Morocco or Trebizond, or whom Biserta sent with Afric shore when Charlemagne with all his peerage fell by Fontarabia, thus far these beyond compare of mortal prowess. So Milton has compared the forces of these warriors with the forces of all of these places, which are unfamiliar to us, to readers today, but they are far beyond these compare of mortal prowess. Yet observed their dread commander, he above the rest, line 590, in shape and gesture proudly eminent, stood like a tower. So Satan is preeminent above the rest. He stands like a tower, line 591, stood like a tower. His form had not yet lost all her original brightness. All right, here he's just using a feminine form to describe brightness, but Satan is still mighty to look upon. Nor appeared less than archangel ruined, and the excess of glory obscured. And here we run into a Homeric simile. This is a ring composition, Homeric simile. You know you recognize a simile by the use of the words as or like. And here in line 594, of glory obscured as, that's the marker. We are approaching a Homeric simile. This is an extensive description. He can't just say that he looks like an archangel ruined and the excess of glory is obscured. So he's only lost a little bit of his glory. And what is it like? It's as, and this is what his glory is like, as when the sun risen looks through the horizontal misty air, shorn of his beams, or from behind the moon in dim eclipse disastrous, twilight sheds on half the nations, and with fear of change perplexes monarchs. That's the end of the simile. So this simile carried on for 6 lines. It's like when the sun is risen and it looks through misty air, that was line 595, shorn of his beams. So the sun is shining through the mist, but you can't see all the beams of the sun. But you still know there's something incredibly bright behind that misty air. That's what Satan is like. He's only lost a little bit, part of his glory. Or when, this is line 596, or when from behind the moon in a dim eclipse you see twilight just shining on half the nations, and with fear of change perplexes monarchs. Kings, of course, this would be very perplexing to a king, especially if you're setting up for a battle. All right, that's what Satan is like, with only part of his glory. He has not lost all of its original brightness. Back to line 599. Darkened so, yet shone above them all the archangel, but his face deep scars of thunder had entrenched, and care sat on his faded cheek. But under brows of dauntless courage and considerate pride, waiting revenge, cruel his eye, but cast signs of remorse and passion to behold. The fellows of his crime. The followers, rather, far other once beheld in bliss, condemned forever now to have their lot in pain, millions of spirits for his fault immersed of heaven, and from eternal splendors flung for his revolt. Here in line 609, Milton refers to millions of spirits. This has always perplexed me a little bit, because I doubt that there were millions. Flung, for from eternal splendors flung for his revolt, line 611. Yet faithful how they stood, their glory withered. And here we have another Homeric simile. You see the marker word as. All right, how do they look as they stand there with their glory withered? As when heaven's fire hath scathed the forest oaks or mountain pines with singed top their stately growth through bare, though bare stands on the blasted heath. This is quite the simile. So the description of all of his men standing there, all of the cast out angels, is as though they have had heaven's fire. You could imagine lightning or something coming down, scorching all of these. They're compared to trees here. Scathed forest oaks or pines, so they're very tall, with singed top, stately growth, though bare, stands on the blasted heath. So the image is of a blasted heath, so it's a very ugly wasteland, and you have all of these trees standing black, scorched of everything green and alive. They're just standing up, these stark black trees. Very powerful imagery here. Line 615. He now prepared to speak, whereat their doubled ranks they bend from wing to wing, and half enclose him round with all his peers. Attention held them mute. Thrice he essayed, and thrice, in spite of scorn, tears such as angels weep burst forth. Line 620. Very interesting, line 619, the use of thrice. Three times he tried, and three times, in spite of scorn, tears such as angels weep burst forth. So Satan is attempting three times to speak without weeping. And three, of course, is the numbers three and the number seven are very prominent in classical literature. Line 620. So his tears burst forth. At last, words interwove with sighs found out their way. And here, this is Satan speaking, his formal speech, which is also common to epic. O myriads of immortal spirits, O powers matchless but with the Almighty, and that strife was not inglorious, though the event was dire, as this place testifies, and this dire change hateful to utter. But what power of mind, foreseeing or presaging from the depth of knowledge past or present, could have feared? How such united force of gods, how such as stood like these, could ever know repulse? In other words, who could have known God could win over us? Line 631. For who can yet believe, though after loss, that all these puissant legions, whose exile hath emptied heaven, all right, there's so many of them, Satan is using an exaggeration, you know, we've emptied heaven, hath emptied heaven, shall fail to reascend, self-raised, and repossess their native seat. So Satan believes they can raise themselves up and repossess their native seat. Line 635. For me, be witness, all the host of heaven, if counsels different or danger shunned by me have lost our hopes. But he who reigns monarch in heaven, till then as one secure, sat on his throne, upheld by old repute, consent or custom, and his regal state put forth at full, but still his strength concealed, which tempted our attempt and wrought our fall. So Satan is blaming God. It is God's fault, because he tempted them, and that he concealed his strength so that they did not realize how strong he was. And Satan is also claiming here that God reigns on his throne, upheld by old repute, so maybe some type of tradition, consent, or custom, not by right. That was line 640, not by right. which tempted our attempt and wrought our fall. Line 642. Henceforth, his might we know, and know our own, so as not either to provoke or dread new war provoked. Our better part remains to work in close design, by fraud or guile, what force affected not. All right? If they can't do it by force, they'll do it by fraud or guile. Line 646. By fraud or guile, what force affected not, that he no less at length from us may find, who overcomes by force, hath overcome but half his foe. Space may produce new worlds, whereof so rife there went a fame in heaven, that he ere long intended to create, and therein plant a generation whom his choice regard should favor equal to the sons of heaven. Thither, if but to pry, shall be perhaps our first eruption. Line 655. All right, there's some type of a creation of a new world. And there's a rumor going out in heaven, a fame in heaven, that ere long, before long, he intended to create and therein plant a generation, all right, this would be Adam and Eve, whom his choice regard should favor equal to the sons of heaven, which are the angels. And so, line 655, hither, if but to pry, okay, over there, even if it's only to spy or to pry, shall be perhaps our first eruption, hither or elsewhere. For this infernal pit shall never hold celestial spirits in bondage, nor the abyss long under darkness cover. But these thoughts full counsel must mature. Line 660. Peace is despaired, for who can think submission? War, then, war open or understood, must be resolved. He spake, and to confirm his words, out flew millions of flaming swords, drawn from the thighs of mighty cherubim. The sudden blaze far round illumined hell. Highly they raged against the highest, and fierce with grasped arms, clashed on their sounding shields the din of war, hurling defiance toward the vault of heaven. These are powerful lines. Satan is finishing his formal speech here, and what do his men do? They're clashing millions of flaming swords, probably against their shields. Clashing their swords against their shields. This is their response, and this is their way to hurl defiance toward the vault of heaven. I call this the furious tantrum. Line 670. There stood a hill not far, whose grisly top belched fire and rolling smoke. The rest entire shone with a glossy scurf, undoubted sign that in his womb was hid metallic ore. So there's a hill nearby that has smoke coming out of it and different signs that show that inside there is probably ore. The work of sulfur. Thither winged with speed, a numerous brigade hastened. All right, so they send off a brigade to go to this hill and see what they can find. This is line 675. And here is the word as. This is another Homeric simile. Very frequent in epics. It's an extended simile. This is quite the metaphor. Of course, you know it uses like or as. Line 675. As, all right, what's it like when they send a brigade to hurry off to go to this hill and look for ore? As when bands of pioneers with spade and pickaxe armed forerun the royal camp to trench a field or cast a rampart, Mammon led them on. Mammon, the least erected spirit that fell from heaven, for even in heaven his looks and thoughts were always downward bent, admiring more the riches of heaven's pavement, trodden gold than aught divine or holy else enjoyed. In vision beatific. By him first men also, and by his suggestion taught, ransacked the center, and with impious hands rifled the bowels of their mother earth for treasures better hid. Soon had his crew opened into the hill a spacious wound and digged out ribs of gold. That's line 690. Going back to the Homeric simile, line 675, what is this compared to? It's just like when a whole bunch of pioneers get together with spades and pickaxes and go to trench a field or cast a rampart. And so Mammon, who in Matthew 6:24 is called the prince of this world, is compared here in Milton's time period to Pluto. Pluto, or Hades, Pluto by the Romans and Hades by the Greeks, was the god of the underworld. And so because he was the god of the underworld, he was the god of mining, of rocks, of anything geology, and that would include gold, gold and ore, things like that. And so that's why Milton has Mammon, this fallen angel whose name is Mammon, leading the men on, because Mammon, even when he was in heaven, was more concerned with looking down at heaven's pavement, at this trodden gold, the gold that you trod on. He's more interested in that than anything divine or for any type of vision beatific. Back to line 690. Let none admire that riches grow in hell, that soil may best deserve the precious bane. This is almost an oxymoron, line 692. A precious bane, because of course something that is a bane is a curse. It's something that's very evil or bad, or it kills, it destroys. And so to call it a precious bane is to let you know what Milton thinks about riches. And here let those who boast in mortal things and wondering tell of Babel, the Tower of Babel, and the works of the Memphian kings, line 694. The Memphian kings, of course, Memphis is in Egypt, and so he's talking about the Egyptian pharaohs and the pyramids. The works of the Memphian kings. Learn how their greatest monuments of fame and strength and art are easily outdone by spirits reprobate. And in an hour, what in an age they, with incessant toil and hands innumerable, scarce perform. So Milton is saying what it took these Egyptian pharaohs at Memphis innumerable generations to do, these reprobate spirits, these evil spirits, can do in an hour. Line 700. Nigh on the plain, in many cells prepared, that underneath had veins of liquid fire sluiced from the lake, a second multitude. So they send out another commission of men. They send out another brigade. A second multitude with wondrous art founded the massy ore. This is a foundry. And a foundry is where metals get melted down to be purified so that they can be used again there to separate. With wondrous art founded the massy ore, severing each kind. All right, so they're separating gold from ore, etc. And scummed the bullion dross. A third, this is another battalion, a third as soon had formed within the ground, line 705, a various mold, and from the boiling cells, by strange conveyance, filled each hollow nook. All right, so they are, a third brigade, is they're making molds in the ground, and like boiling cells, they're filling each hollow nook. And what's it like? This is the Homeric simile, line 708. 706, 708, yes. As in an organ, from one blast of wind to many a row of pipes, the soundboard breathes. That's what this is like. It's just like when a pipe organ sends a blast of air into all of these places. That's what it's like as they carve out these places and fill each hollow nook. Line 710. Anon, out of the earth, a fabric huge rose like an exhalation. That's how fast their building progresses. It rises like an exhalation. With the sound of dulcet symphonies and voices sweet, built like a temple. All right, what are they building? They're building something that looks similar to a temple. And this would be classic for Milton, because obviously, if these are evil angels building something, it will probably look like something pagan. Built like a temple, where pilasters round were set, and Doric pillars, Doric is a style, overlaid with golden architrave, nor did their want, and remember this is in line 715, the King James usage of the word want, you can replace that with lack. Nor did their want lack cornice or frieze with bossy sculptures graven. The roof was fretted gold, not Babylon, nor great Alcaro, that's Cairo, Egypt, such magnificence equaled in all their glories to enshrine Belus or Serapis. This Belus is Baal, Baal, and Serapis is Osiris, their gods, line 720, or seat their kings when Egypt with Assyria strove in wealth and luxury. The ascending pile stood fixed her height, stately height, and straight the doors opening, their brazen folds discover wide within her ample spaces, o'er the smooth and level pavement, from the arched roof, pendant by subtle magic, many a row of starry lamps and blazing cressets, fed with naphtha and asphaltus, yielded light as from a sky. Line 730. The hasty multitude admiring entered, and the work some praise, and some the architect. All right, some praise the work, the building, and some are praising the architect. His hand was known in heaven by many a towered structure high, where sceptered angels held their residence and sat as princes, whom the supreme king exalted to such power and gave to rule, each in his hierarchy, the orders bright, nor was his name unheard or unadored. In ancient Greece and in Ausonian land, men called him Mulciber. All right, this is the architect. Men called him Mulciber, line 740. And Mulciber also fell. We have this this image of Mulciber, who is also called Hephaestus by the Greeks. Then he is called Vulcan by the Romans, line 740. And how he fell from heaven, they fabled, thrown by angry Jove, that is Zeus, sheer o'er the crystal battlements, from morn to noon he fell, from noon to dewy eve, a summer's day, and with the setting sun, dropped from the zenith, line 745, like a falling star on Lemnos, the Aegean Isle. Thus they relate, erring, for he with this rebellious rout fell long before, nor aught availed him now to have built in heaven high towers, nor did he scape by all his engines, but was headlong sent with his industrious crew to build in hell. Meanwhile the winged heralds, by command of sovereign power, with awful ceremony and trumpets, sound throughout the host proclaim a solemn council forthwith to be held at Pandemonium. Line 756. Pandemonium. So we have trumpets announcing a council will take place. The high capital of Satan and his peers. Their summons called from every band and squared regiment, by place or choice, the worthiest. They anon, with hundreds and with thousands, trooping came, line 760, attended. All access was thronged, the gates and porches wide, but chief the spacious hall, though like a covered field, where champions bold wont ride in armed, and at the Soldan's chair, the Sultan's chair, defied the best of Paynim chivalry, pagan chivalry, line 765, to mortal combat or career with lance. Thick swarmed, both on the ground and in the air. All right, the council has been called, and what are they like? Both on the ground and in the air, brushed with the hiss of rustling wings, and we have another Homeric simile in line 768. And the signal here is the word as. So Homeric simile. Also, one point that's very interesting is that very often Homeric similes make comparisons of large numbers of men to large numbers of bees. And this may symbolize power, it may symbolize some type of strength, also the organization, the way that they work together. And here we have a simile. As bees in springtime, when the sun with Taurus rides, pour forth their populous youth about the hive in clusters, they among fresh dews and flowers fly to and fro, or on the smoothed plank, the suburb of their straw-built citadel, new rubbed with balm, expatiate and confer their state affairs, line 775. So thick the airy crowd swarmed and were straitened, till the signal given, behold a wonder. They but now, who seemed in bigness to surpass earth's giant sons, now less than smallest dwarfs, in narrow room throng numberless. All right, what are they doing? Basically, that's line 779, they shrink to fit. Earth's giant sons, these are the sons of Earth, the angels, now less than smallest dwarfs, in narrow room throng numberless, line 780. Like, this is another Homeric simile, the use of like or as, line 780, like that Pygmean race beyond the Indian mount, or fairy elves whose midnight revels by a forest side or fountain some belated peasant sees, or dreams he sees, while overhead the moon sits arbitress, line 785, and nearer to the earth wheels her pale course. They, on their mirth and dance intent, with jocund music charm his ear. At once with joy and fear his heart rebounds. Line 789. Thus incorporeal spirits to smallest forms reduced their shapes immense, and were at large, though without number, still amidst the hall of that infernal court. But far within, and in their own dimensions like themselves, the great seraphic lords and cherubim, in close recess and secret conclave, sat a thousand demigods on golden seats, frequent and full. After short silence then, and summons read, the great consult began. And this is the end of Book One. The leaders are deep within. The hordes are outside. They've shrunk. They are, you know, singing and dancing and celebrating that they have built Pandemonium. And the leaders here at the very end, lines 792, but far within, you have the seraphic lords and the cherubim. And so those that are highest up on the hierarchy are meeting now, preparing a council. And of course, Book 2 will tell us what their council is about.